Let's pray. Dear Father in heaven, I pray for your blessing upon us and upon myself in particular as we look at this important topic. May we have insight and understanding. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Reading Genesis today, in many ways a very challenging topic, particularly when it comes to the first 11 chapters, right? Because there are some fairly fantastical sounding things in there. The whole world created in the space of a week. A talking serpent, haven't met one of those recently. Most people haven't, unless they're on magic mushrooms. And I'm not saying Moses or Adam was, or Eve. But that's the way we would look at it in common everyday life. Worldwide flood, amazing longevity, the confounding of the tongues of Babel. These are things that seem to be just that bit different to what follows. The first thing I want to say is that Genesis provides an orientation for reading the whole of the rest of Scripture, the Old Testament and the New Testament. I've written a chapter in a book that Dr. Brian Ball has been editing. In the Beginning, Science and Scripture Confirm Creation, the book is called. And in this chapter, I speak about the way in which Genesis introduces, particularly the first 11 chapters, in fact, some very important scriptural themes. For example, the oneness of God, the goodness of creation. The reality of cosmic conflict is there from at least chapter 3. There are even hints of it perhaps earlier. The sinfulness of humanity, the balance of work and rest, the blessing of a helper. And by the way, when it says a helper suitable for man, it should really be translated as a strength comparable to man. I like that. The conditionality of life, the status of a remnant is there. Redemption as a renewed creation is an important theme. The coming Messiah, and the importance of a response of faith. And with all of that being there in those first 11 chapters, I would be the last of any person to dismiss those chapters. Where the troubles come in, of course, are with things like contemporary scientific data, which some of you know much better than I do, and how to fit it in with the time periods and so forth that are presented there. And when we study this in class, we go through some of the different options that have been presented. It's not the heart of the course, in fact. We go through a whole lot first on those first couple of chapters. But at the end of that period, I will go through with students what some of the options are that have been presented in an attempt to reconcile what we are seeing in the Bible with what people are perceiving in the natural world as well. And my attempt in doing that with students is simply to try and create a space for them to show a little tolerance perhaps to those who may have a different opinion to themselves. If they're out in ministry, the last thing I want to see them doing is grabbing hold of some young person who's a science student at university and being confronted with difficult issues and forcing them into a position of confusion and having to choose between different things they know in different ways and perhaps forcing them out of faith. I invite my students to leave enough space for people to be different and to say to them, even if you don't understand this, even if I don't understand it, that is no reason to throw faith in Jesus Christ out. That's the most important thing of all. Some attempts that have been made, and I think some are better than others. One suggestion that you'd be aware of course, is that the days are very long periods. They're not simply 24-hour days. I think that that's the weakest attempt, in my opinion, from the point of view of the biblical text. I don't find that terribly convincing. The days have an evening and morning. The seventh day isn't mentioned as having one, but that is simply a variation because you've come to the climax. It doesn't mean that it's any different to the other days. I think the writer couldn't have made it more clear than is already clear that it was meant to be understood as seven literal days. Other attempts are made as well. The idea of a passive gap between the first and the second verses, the idea that God originally created the heavens and the earth and that the earth was void and empty, and then sometime later God came along and began to make it ordered so that human beings could live in it. That was what I was taught at Andrews University, and I think Andrews' conservative credentials would not be questioned by anyone serious. And that is one attempt that is put up. I have some trouble with it in the sense that I don't sense that the text is really trying to say, for example, that the sun and moon and stars were already there long ages beforehand as well. I get the impression from the description of the fourth day that the sun and moon and stars are created on that day. Now, you can read it a little bit differently. You can read it to say, let the stars that are in the heavens take up this function of giving light. That's a possibility. But it does appear to me that if a firmament is separated from the earth only 3 days beforehand, there doesn't seem to be a real lot of gap in there for an empty world with the universe all around it. But that is one attempt to reconcile science to some extent with the text. The problem, of course, is, as a scientist will assure us, is that the evidence of fossils and all is mixed up with the rocks, and you can't simply separate biology out from the discussion. But there's a problem with it in the text itself, it seems to me. Another attempt is to say that there is sort of an active gap between the two. This was in the Scofield Reference Bible, very familiar to dispensationalists. So amongst that branch of very conservative Christians, it has gained some credence. Amongst Adventists, Jack Provencher was known for putting forward this idea as well. The suggestion was that God created the universe, that maybe the devil got in there and mucked some things up and made a terrible mess of it all. And then at some stage, after billions of years, you come to about 6,000 to 10,000 years ago, and God spends a week making it new. Okay. So in this particular theory, there is a gap like in the previous one, but it is a gap that has some explanation for biological residue of various sorts being left behind. And again, it's not impossible to read the text this way. It seems to me that the difficulty is that it doesn't seem to be a particularly natural way to read the text. It doesn't spring out to your eyes as the obvious way to go. More recently, Professor John Walton has presented in a book that I've heard discussed at these education events, the idea that the creation week is the setting up of a creation as a temple. So there's an earlier creation. There is, in fact, in the earlier creation, all sorts of living forms made. But when it comes to man appearing, God prepares the world specifically for the purpose of human beings being his image there. And the 7 days are seven actual days in which God orders everything into such a pattern that it is ready for that to happen. And again, I would say that that's a feasible reading of the text, but not an obvious one. It doesn't immediately strike you between the eyes that there were several practice runs before this final one-week inauguration of the temple. Another idea is that the 7 days simply represent a framework for presenting the creation, that the elements are not necessarily in order, although I think if you tried to jumble the order, you'd have trouble making sense of it. In this theory, it's often suggested that the days may not be contiguous or consecutive. You know what we mean by contiguous? One after the other, consecutive in a particular order. Again, the most obvious way to read it is to read it as consecutive and contiguous, but I have to admit, looking at the Hebrew closely, that the text is not absolutely dogmatic on that in a way we might imagine. For example, it speaks about the first day. There was an evening and a morning, and then what does it say? Day one. Thank you. I thought no one might answer me because it was a trick question, you see. But Arthur got the answer right. It's day one. It doesn't actually say the first day. It says day one, or you can even translate it as one day. And then you have another evening and a morning, and it is the second day. Now, the interesting thing in the Hebrew is that normally if you're saying something like the second day, it will say the day, the second one. That's the pattern you follow in Hebrew. The adjective normally comes after the noun, and if it's definite, both elements need to be definite. Both need to have the in it. The fascinating thing with Genesis chapter 1 is that the V is not there in that instance. It says, a day, the second one. And grammarians will scratch their heads over such a thing, right? Because it's not the normal way of doing it. I haven't checked it out for myself, but I have read that it doesn't happen anywhere else in the Bible, but in Genesis chapter 1. And then it goes on to a day, the third one, a day, the fourth one, a day, the fifth one. And then it says, the day, the sixth one. Then you've got it in the normal pattern, right? And then it comes to the seventh day, and the way that the Masoretes have pointed to the text, it says, the day, the seventh one. But the fact is, it depends on the vowel pointings, and, that can be disputed. An interesting pattern would be a bit like if someone said to me, what did you do when you were up at the street in Morissette? I could say, one thing I did was this, a second thing was this, a third was this, a fourth was this, a fifth was this, the sixth was this one, the seventh was this one. And such a way of speaking in English, at least, need not necessarily mean that the order is consecutive or contiguous. So I know we're contemplating putting that into our beliefs, okay? And it is up to the community as a whole how it expresses its beliefs. But I would sound the caution that biblically, the language doesn't quite lend itself to that. Okay? And if they change their beliefs accordingly and they come back to me and say, you said that back at that meeting? I will say, well, we changed them once, we can change them back, can't we? With a slight desperation in my voice at that moment. Another theory is that these are days of announcement. Or we'll go back a step even before that. A theory that was around for a long time was that they are days of revelation. That God revealed what happened in creation to Moses one day after another over a 7-day period. Okay, so when Moses recorded it, he's recording how he saw it one day after the other after a 7-day period. It's not necessarily, according to this argument, reflecting the actual time creation took. And again, that's a possibility, but it doesn't seem the most natural way to read it. One of the most interesting theories I've come across is the idea that these are days of announcement. But this represents a 1-day week, but it represents, not a 1-day week, a 7-day week, but it represents a 7-day week billions of years ago. Okay. And God announced on the first day that he was going to create light. And then in your mind, you are meant to put parenthesis around what follows. That's how God made the light. And then you have the expression, there was an evening and a morning, one day. And then the second day, the third day, the fourth day, so it goes on. You have an announcement of what's going to do. You have in brackets, that's how God did it. It's not telling you exactly when. And then you have a reference to the time period, which was the time period when he supposedly made the announcement. And you can read the Hebrew in such a fashion. You can put brackets around the various descriptions of how things were fulfilled, parenthesis them out, and just make the evenings and the mornings refer to the days, the times that the announcements were made. In that way, you actually end up with a very literal reading of the text and still allow time for billions of years to pass by. And it seems to me the thing that we have to be very careful with if we're trying to nail everything down in almost a creedal fashion is that you can never quite do it well enough, right? However tightly you make that creed, there will be ways for people to slip through. If you're making creeds not as a confession of what we share in common with Christ, but to include some and exclude others, it becomes a very difficult task to make the statement exclusionary enough. So if you want to say the days are consecutive and contiguous and literal, someone who believes that they are days of announcement can affirm all of that. So if we're going to really tighten them up to exclude, we're going to have to do a lot better than is even being proposed at the minute. It becomes a very difficult thing. What else can we say? I think we do need to remember in the whole topic that the writer is not writing history for its own sake, but is writing history as an introduction. What is the introduction to? Beginning of a story. God is prominent in the story. But it's introducing the story, particularly of God, in relation to one people in the Old Testament, and that's the people of Israel. This is all background to the story of Abraham. Okay. And you remember when Abraham is called, it tells us there in Genesis chapter 12 that he is to be a blessing to all nations. For him and his seed, all the families of the earth will be blessed. It's introduction to that statement. If you didn't have those first 11 chapters, you might forget at times as you read on the universal purpose God has in calling this people to himself. But the fact that those 11 chapters are there with their big cosmic themes reminds us to read the whole story against a cosmic background. And of course, once you come to Jesus Christ, the cosmic significance of the story becomes plain. But those first 11 chapters are background to the story to remind the reader, to remind Israel itself of its special function. And I think that means that those chapters are not simply history in the way we might sometimes think of it. It's almost in the realms of, and I could be misunderstood here, and I don't want to be, it's almost in the realms of prehistory in a sense. If you ask people about their families, what their parents did when they did things, they tend to get a bit hazy when it gets back to before they were born, okay? If you ask me about my parents, and some of you knew them back before I was born, I could give you all sorts of answers, but I might be hazy on the particular dates because that is before time as we know it, or at least time as I know it. It's not part of my experience. This is all time before Israel knew it. It's background to their story. It's important to their story, but it is not part of their story in the same sense as is anything that follows. And that may mean, while indeed it is history, it is history of a different order, perhaps, in some respects, than we might think of. Daniel Renno gives a good illustration of this when he's discussing collecting of oral stories in the Pacific. He speaks, for example, about the Aborigines in the Northern Territory having stories of their meeting with Captain Cook. Now, did Captain Cook ever get to the Northern Territory? I understand not, okay? And yet the Aborigines in the Northern Territory have stories of the encounter. What status should we give such a story? We could call it a myth, and that would leave, at least in the non-academic setting, a lot of potential for misunderstanding. Is it irrelevant? Are those stories irrelevant to historical research?
Not to the Aborigines.
No. I would say in a deep sense those stories are very true. It did, and that records that story for them from their perspective, even if we wouldn't say that the story happened in the way, exact way, that it's described. In another way, it really did happen. And, you know, being conservative, I can feel uncomfortable with that sort of approach, but in fact we do it with Jesus' parables, don't we? Parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Do dead people talk to each other? Are you sure? What does that parable say? I tell you, when I've spoken to people who don't share our view on the state of the dead and said, but that is a parable, you can't take the details of that to prove the dead are talking, they laugh at me and say, you've just thrown all the parables out of the Bible, right? And I don't believe I have at all. But because they're saying historically literal equals truth, in their minds, if I say that the parables didn't necessarily happen as such, for the illustrative stories, they get very upset with me. So it may be that here we're dealing with something a little in some ways like the material in Revelation, right? Some people take that very literally and come up with some extraordinarily strange conclusions. And they do it against the text because the text itself speaks about it being signifying what God had revealed. And Jesus taking the message and signifying it to John in symbolic language. They ignore that element. So when we're dealing with something that is unique in the Bible, when we're dealing with material that is talking about a unique period, we do have to be a little bit cautious about trying to draw conclusions from it that may not be at all what the author intended. And at the end of the day, I think that that's the most comfortable place I sit with the various proposals that are put forward about how the different stories may fit together with what we observe. The others all reek of a little bit of desperation, it seems to me. But to say that this is a story that is part of a section that is a little different to the way things are expressed elsewhere in the Bible, I've got to be humble enough to say from my point of view as a theology lecturer that I need to leave space for scientists as well to look at that, and I need to admit that the scripture itself may allow some space that I might not want to grant, but it's probably in the text there too. Another important point, it seems to me, is to realise that the Bible will use the language of its own day. We sometimes forget that because we look at translations, of course, and they're in the language of our day, and there's already a gap there that's been reduced for us. But it does use the language of its own day, and it includes the cultural or scientific understandings. Don McMahon, a friend of mine, has written on the issue of Ellen White and health reform, and he's done a remarkable job in identifying the fact that Ellen White rates so highly compared to contemporary recommendations for health reform. He gave her a 90% rating or something, and other health reformers of the day, some of whose writings she used, were much, much lower in their correlation. Okay, and I remember Don saying to me, but what Ellen White does is that she gives recommendations for healthful living that correspond very well with contemporary recommendations, but her explanations for backing them up, the physiology she uses to back them up, doesn't always correspond quite so well. And the reason is, of course, that if you're going to explain something in your own setting, you have to use reasons and logic that make sense to the people you're communicating with. If Ellen White had tried to communicate her health recommendations using 21st century language, that might have been great from our point of view. It would have been disastrous from the point of view of anyone reading her up until now, because it wouldn't have made any sense. And no doubt the way we would want to express it today in 20 years' time may not make much sense either, let alone 100 years' time. So his understanding was that Ellen White gave inspired recommendations, but under the inspiration of the Spirit, used her own knowledge in her own time to explain it to the people of her time. And there are things a little bit like that, it seems to me, in Genesis. Go through Genesis 1 sometime and look at what it says about the firmament and how the firmament is made. Yeah. Right? The firmament is separated from the earth and lifted up. What does that tell you for a start? What are we thinking of? What does, even in English, the word firmament, the first part of a word is firm, something solid. Okay. And where are the various things in creation in relation to the firmament? The land is below. Where do the birds fly? It doesn't say in it. It says across the surface of it. I almost have this vision of them flying on their backs like this, you know, which is not what the Hebrew is actually saying, but that's a vision that instantly comes to my mind. If they're flying across the surface of the firmament, perhaps they're flying up on their backs, which is not what the text means, but I just can't help myself. They're underneath the firmament. Where are the sun, moon and the stars? They're in the firmament. And where are the waters that are above? They're above the firmament. Okay? Now you think about that strictly literally for a moment. It's all around. Yes, it appears that they had a view of a dome, a circular dome with a earth here, on an ocean of waters, and waters up above the firmament as well, up above where the sun and moon and stars are. I don't know anyone who actually takes that strictly literally. Okay. There are people who speak about the possibility of the waters being up there as a canopy at the beginning. I know scientists have terrible trouble thinking of the physics of that. There are people who have tried to explain it that way, but if you sit with those people and say, well, is that canopy above the sun and the moon and the stars, they're not going to tell you that. I have no reason to believe that probably for the first readers, there was no particular difficulty with any of this. They had that view of a dome, and that was probably it. And the idea of waters above the sun and the moon and the stars, I don't think would have troubled them terribly much at all, because that's probably what they actually believed. Now, use your common sense. Go out and have a look at it. You see the blue. There's something there, right? If you're just going by your senses, if you're using the language of appearance, it's like the sunrise and the sunset. That's the way you're going to talk about it. And I suspect that's the way they did speak about it. Now, I know some have found in Assyrian some reference to firmament being related to the, you know, the wind, the atmosphere. And that's fair enough as far as it goes, but I think the Bible itself is closer to the world of Moses. Job 37 verse 18 speaks about beating out the firmament like a mirror. Okay, it does appear that they were thinking of it in terms of an object. I suspect that when it speaks of a windows of a heaven opening up, they thought of actual windows. Now, no one today basically thinks of literal windows. Does that mean we're in error or they were in error? I think it is to miss the point. The literalness of the windows was not really what the text was about. The text was about speaking about how God has ordered the creation and is the source of the whole creation. I don't think we're therefore meant to take something that's incidental in the text and turn it into some type of shibboleth for whether a person has truth or not. Numbers can be used in different ways to how we may use them today. When I look at the stories, the genealogies, you've got very long life periods there and people having children very, very late in the piece. These extensions of life, the highest is, what is the highest one? 969, was it, for Methuselah? These are very conservative compared to what the Sumerians had, for instance. They had some running close to the millions of years. Okay, so everything has to be looked at in its context. One of the difficulties we have is that if you go to the Septuagint and the Samaritan Pentateuch, the text varies. And that, to me, instantly raises a warning about what's going on. Because I don't think that it's a case of people deliberately trying to pervert the word of God. Copyists were generally a little more careful than that. But why in the different traditions do you have the numbers varying? What are the numbers trying to tell us? Perhaps the numbers are meant to be conveying truth to us at a different level than simply adding up lengths of periods. We know that symbolic numbers were very important in the time of the Hebrews in their way of understanding. Numbers like three, okay, things happening on the third day. Numbers like the number four, the four corners of the earth, and that's another interesting topic. John has four corners of the earth, but you might have trouble finding four corners today. It's just a way of speaking. It's on the ABC, it is, but it is a metaphoric way of speaking, and we acknowledge it. The number seven, of course, with the Sabbath, the number 12, a number of the disciples, a number of the tribes. Incidentally, the tribes are a great case in point, because if you try and name the 12 tribes of Israel, you will have a tremendously difficult time of doing it. You will find there's a lot more than 12 tribes. But every list only ever has 12. The number is more important than the actual number. That's a warning. The number 40, the 40 days that Jesus was in the wilderness, the 40 days Moses was up the mountain, the 40 years they wandered in the desert. Did you know that if you go from Adam to Noah, all the ages end in 0, 5, 7, 2 and 9? 7, 2 and 9. I don't know why I've got the 2 before the 9 instead of after the 0, but there you go. I copied that from somewhere. I didn't check it out. You may find that I am wrong. But the chances of all the other numbers being missing is actually astronomically small. You go over both from Adam to Noah and then after the flood, there are no numbers ending in 1 or 6. Intriguing. The chances of that happening coincidentally are very small. Dr. Gerhard Hasel, one of my teachers at Andrews, argued that the times were meant to be understood very literally, that there was no systematization of numbers going on. I suspect he was wrong, frankly. Okay, because for certain numbers to be missing like that, I don't know what the exact message of all that is, but I suspect we're in a world where numbers are being dealt with differently than we might think of them being today. Other areas. The interesting thing to me is usually when we think about the difficulty of reading Genesis in the 21st century, we're thinking of science, religion issues, but there are other things that I find very hard to get as a 21st century person, I must admit. Hagar is one of those. What would we do today if a couple were having trouble having children and the wife says to her husband, get the housekeeper and have one with her? No, artificial insemination back in those days, remember? That would be a different thing. But what would we think about? Wouldn't it be appropriate under Australian law to go to one of your workers and Do you think Hagar was asked if she wanted to do this or not? She's a servant. I don't think it was likely she was asked. I mean, it's possible. All sorts of things are possible, as we've already discussed, but aren't always the obvious reading of the text. I don't think as a servant, it would have been considered that her opinion of a matter was particularly important. Right? She should be grateful that there was such an offer on the table. And of course, what happens is that Hagar gets very uppity about it. It seems like she was happy enough with the result, right? But under Australian law, I think Abraham would have been sent to jail. Does that mean that Abraham was a criminal? No. Certainly not. Was he committing adultery? I personally don't think under his understanding it would have been considered adultery. It was all in the family. Okay. It certainly wasn't about lust. It was about getting another child. That was their motive. And that was important. God had told him he needed one after all. Though he hadn't told him to get one that way, one would have to admit. Does that mean Australian law is wrong? If Abraham was not, it was a mistake, but if it was not a criminal act for Abraham, does that mean I can go and do the same? Well, I don't have a wife, but does it mean anyone here who wants another child can go and grab someone at work who's under their authority and say, do this? It's important to let the world speak in its own terms. And at the same time to understand why it may not be acceptable for us today to do the same thing. There are a lot of patriarchal things in the stories of Genesis that I wouldn't want to emulate. Okay? When I say patriarchal, I don't mean as in the patriarchs of a faith, but in terms of a patriarchal understanding of society where men are on top, right? And women do exactly what they're told. The great thing, of course, in Genesis is you've got the opening creation story with its power comparable to man, with woman coming from the side and not from the head or the feet. You've got all these elements that teach an egalitarianism but is not practiced later on in the stories themselves. Right? The world has fallen into sin and even the best people are marred by it. So the story has the ability to point beyond itself. So I can read those other things in there and somehow accommodate them in my understanding of how it all works because the story transcends them itself. Rachel and Leah is another example. Two wives. I had an uncle at one stage. He married one of my aunts, but he had gone for a short time. He kept company for a short time with another one, with her sister. Yeah. And he used to joke about the Rachel and Leah stuff. And the aunt he wasn't married to would... She didn't actually hit him, but she looked like she wanted to about these jokes. It was just a joke. But complicated stuff if you're not careful, obviously. Under Australian law, would we have insisted that Jacob was married to Leah when he woke up the next morning and found it was the wrong woman? Yes. You can lie before you get married in Australia. You can lie about money and all sorts of things, but you can't actually... Yeah, don't always have legal status there, but some of them do. Anything. Yes, I know. I've been there. There you are, the dead do speak. Yeah. For the record, I don't believe that. Okay. under Australian law, if you're doing a proxy wedding and ended up by fraud, you were married to someone else than you thought you were, it's not going to stand. The law is very clear on that. Under their understanding, it stood. We're dealing with a significant cultural difference. Then there's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Richard Dawkins points to this story, and I'm not surprised in a way, given his purposes. Lot stands at the door as the crowd is trying to rape his visitors, and let's not pretend it's something else. The text doesn't use the word rape. They don't say, bring them out and we'll rape them, but that's clearly their intent. Abusers never own honestly what they're actually doing, do they? They always couch it in more polite terms. And he says, what does he say? Do you remember his response to the crowd of men? By the way, there may not have just been men in that group. I didn't mean to mention that. The Hebrew is ambiguous enough. There could have been some women in that group hollering as well. It simply means people at the end of the day. So he says, take my virgin daughters. They've never been with a man. Take them and do what you like. Is there any father in this room who's going to repeat those words with respect to his beautiful daughters? Arthur's looking around to see if there's any... Oh, yes, okay. Would you offer your daughter under such circumstances? I think it is absolutely horrendous, and so does Richard Dawkins. He says, what a primitive book. Adriel is relieved she has her father as her father and not Lot as her father. Mind you, what Lot's daughters did next suggests to me that they may have been virgins in body, they were not very virginal in mind. They had been influenced in some way or other by where they were living, I think. But you look at that story, and again, you're dealing with a very significant cultural gap. Why does Lot respond like that? We can say, it's hospitality. These were his guests he had to look after. Well, why didn't he offer himself? Wouldn't most parents rather go through suffering themselves than have it happen to their child? Again, you have to take the patriarchal background into account. If the patriarch's gone, who can help anyone? And we have to remember that in their minds, and it comes out in the story of Gibeah as well, what's going on is this. For a woman to be treated as a woman by force is bad. But for a man to be treated as a woman is totally repugnant. Therefore, you send your daughter out first. I can't judge Lot by my understanding of the topic. Okay? At the same time, it doesn't mean that his understanding is correct. In the same way as with Hagar. I have to keep in mind the difference of their world to mine and respect both, not just one or the other. What is often done with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, of course, is quite appalling. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah is sometimes taken as a great example of being against gay people. It is rather tragic that in the contemporary world, and it's not totally the fault of Christians, but it is in part our fault, the media has a lot to do with it too, but we haven't done much to correct them at times. The thing we're known most for is wanting to exclude gay people from everything. If you speak to the average secular person and say, what is important to Christians, sadly, however wrongly, they will reply that that is the most important thing. And this story plays right into it. I was in a Sabbath school class at one stage where someone was talking about this story and said, the story reminded them of Ellen DeGeneres and her partner, Australian woman Portia Rossi, is it? It reminded him of that story. And I'm sitting there, oh no, doesn't he realise that this woman over here has a gay child? And there was, in fact, another woman there I'd forgotten at the moment who was gay herself coming along, right? And here is coming out this story, and I think, good grief. Is that what it's about? I think, in fact, that it's got a lot more to do with Abu Ghraib prison, if you want a contemporary example. You've heard of Abu Ghraib? The Iraqi prison where American soldiers, male and female, sexually abused some of the Iraqi prisoners. Now, did the men involved in that, were they sexually abusing those other men because they were gay? No. I think if you said that to them, they'd be horrified at the thought. It had nothing to do with attraction. It had everything to do with humiliation. Humiliation of the foreigner. Okay? Strange indeed that in America, where I have lived, and I have a lot of respect for the culture, but in fact there's a lot more outcry about the idea of a man marrying another man than there is about what those soldiers did. Yet, which is actually nearer the Sodom story. Okay? So I'm not wanting to draw a conclusion on the whole discussion of gay issues here. I'm simply wanting to point out that, again, we need to see the similarity and the differences between our worlds and understand why both of those are important to take account of. At the end of the day, I think three great messages come forth from Genesis. There are more than that, as I mentioned at the beginning, but there are three that I would want to remember all the time. I can't remember that whole list, even though I've written on it. I don't have it hanging in my head the whole time. But three things I do. One is that this book is a message of faith. Time and again you have announcements of plot. Lawrence Turner devised that term to describe what happens in Genesis. Announcement of what is going to happen in the story. Then you have the story unfold, the plot unfolds, and it doesn't quite match the announcement. And there are reasons for that. And it seems like it's because the people are trying to fulfill the plot under their own steam. Yeah? When Paul points to the idea of Abraham taking Hagar as an example of lack of faith, He is correct. I think the story itself is saying that. Here is Abraham trying to help God out and fulfilling the promise, and it's a disaster. The lack of faith is more significant in fact than the fact that it's polygamous, right? So it's a message about faith. Another reminder of a message of the Sabbath there. Remember, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. However you interpret Genesis 1, at the end of the day, the story is reminding us, when you have a climax in chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, that God made us not for endless exploitation, but for fellowship with him. In a world where business runs constantly, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, how important is that message of the Sabbath? And if paradise has been lost, of course paradise will be regained. And that's another important message of Genesis as well. And however we struggle with, whatever differing answers we come up with, whatever conflicts we get in between one another within the community of faith about those different answers, I think we'll be on the right track if we remember those three central things. That the book is teaching us the importance of faith in God, that it's teaching us that life is not constant exploitation and toil, that we're made for fellowship instead, and it's teaching us that God will bring paradise back again. And of course, in the meantime, we should be making earth, as it is, as much paradise for people as possible. Thank you. Any questions? Maybe I need Arthur up here to protect me at this point. From this hostile crowd that is more dangerous and frightening than the one in Sodom, though for different reasons. And you won't get my daughter.
I'll come up, but I've got my own. Yeah. Ross, thank you so much for that big picture. Look at these earnest people. You can interact directly.
Oh, okay. He's assured me you're safe.
Ross, you didn't mention what I've heard from Lawrence Turner and others of the Genesis first chapter is a Hebrew poem of things balancing each other.
It's designed in a symmetrical structure that is poetic, if you like. You have the first day where you have a creation of light, the form, and then you have it on the fourth day filled out with the light bearers is the one way that it's been translated, the lights there. And then the second day, you have a separation of the firmament from the earth, and you have a mention, therefore, of what is created in the seas, and you have what is created above. And then the third day, how does it go? Have I got the order wrong there? My mind's a bit tired this afternoon. I should know the order better than that, shouldn't I? I mean, I'm teaching it all the time. So there you are. But you have the first 3 days of a form, and then the next 3 days of a filling, and then that's the third day. Okay. And then you come to the seventh day, which stands all out as an unparalleled blessing. That poetic type of structure doesn't mean the language itself is poetic as such. It's not set out in most of it. It is when God speaks and says, let us make man in our image and so forth. But most of it is not set out in parallel lines in contemporary Bibles. I think it would be difficult to do. So I would say it has a poetic style of structure and having parallelisms between the first 3 days and the next three. But I would dispute that it's actually poetry as such.
Oh, I don't think he ever meant that it was poetry between them.
No. Not quite chiastic, because chiastic goes 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. This is 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
I think most of us, even here when we're not so tired, are familiar with the order of creation. But in Genesis 2, the order is quite different.
Sure.
The first living creature created before Genesis 2 was a living human male. Before the plant, before the animal.
That's the first thing that's created. Then
God creates plants to put in Eden. And then he puts Adam in Eden, so there's no animals in Eden.
And then he brings the animals to him.
And then he creates the animals and brings them to Adam to name them. And Adam gets sick of that after a while. So God, the last living creature created in Genesis 2, is it human female? So
the supreme climax of creation.
Yeah, but there's quite a difference between the sequence, between the two.
Sure. The stories are telling things from a different angle.
Well, the question is, if the sequences are so different, is it appropriate to take either or both of them as a literal sequence?
That's one way of looking at it. I'm not terribly persuaded myself. Because you look at the NIV and it will say God had made the plants. He had made the animals, and that's quite a legitimate way to translate the Hebrew. Oh, that's quite legitimate. There are other places in the Hebrew where the reader is expected to work out which it is using their common sense. So someone who knows the first story would read the second story and probably translate it as an ancient Israelite the way that the NIV has. It wouldn't see them as inherently contradictory, therefore.
Because in Genesis 1, clearly the animals were made before the humans.
Mm.
But Adam has tried to review all these animals in Genesis 2 and see that he hasn't got a part amongst them.
But if you translated God had made the animals, as the NIV and most modern translations do, any apparent contradiction is gone. And I think that's legitimate, actually. Yeah. Would you agree with me, David? David's here, Old Testament teacher, colleague from PAU days, now back in Australia. Good to have you and Carol here.
The fourth day of creation, the sun and the moon were made. And then it says in the sentence, he made the stars also.
Mm.
Do you allow for the fact that the making of the stars could have happened long before?
Okay. Yeah, you've got the... It speaks there about let the... it can be translated, let there be lights in the heavens for lighting. Okay, as if God made it on the seventh day. It can also be read as, let the lights that are in the heavens be for lighting. Let them take up this function. Is another possible translation of the Hebrew. And then when it says, he made the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and it speaks about how he made the stars also. Yeah, it's possible to bracket it out. The text is brilliant in a sense, in terms of something coming from the ancient world. It is written with an ambiguity that allows all sorts of different ways of doing things. It's very fluid. And it's, I don't believe in a dictation theory of inspiration, so I'm not saying God dictated it that way. But it is truly remarkable to me that the way it has come down has that fluidity in it that would allow more than one way of looking at some things. The problem is that it's not, it seems to me, natural to think of the sun, moon and stars being there thousands of years beforehand, if the firmament's only been separated from the dry land 3 days earlier. It doesn't seem the most obvious reading, but it's possible. And the strange thing is to me that people will say, okay, we'll go with that possibility to save our necks on astronomical spans of time. But if anyone else tries to wedge a bit of possibility in somewhere else, they get very upset. But the text is full of things that full of possibilities, not most of them immediately obvious possibilities. Yeah.
Jim, Lawrence Turner's book, Back to the Present, on Genesis, he says that the way that was said, this medicine, and the stars as well, was quite scandalous in the ancient world because everything was apparently ruled by the stars. So that was a way of saying your destiny is not by the stars. So in the culture there, it was like, it's written in an offhand way to say it's dismissing of the idea that your destiny is held by astrology and the stars.
Absolutely.
He says that it's a way of saying it's, and not by the way, that those stars, things we think that they just have. I mean, he's a better, of course, but you know, the idea that it's a nothing.
Gerhard Hassel made a lot of this as well, even though he was insistent on taking it very literally. He took position that the story was written as a polemic as well against the neighbouring cultures. You go to the Enuma Elish, that's the Babylonian account of creation, and the stars are given far more attention than the sun and the moon because of their astrological significance. They're the biggies. And the sun and the moon are footnoted to the end. It's the opposite in this story. The stars are put in their place, and the sun and moon are not even here. They are elsewhere in the Old Testament, but they're not even here called the sun and the moon. They're simply called lights because as soon as you translate it into Akkadian or into Egyptian, as soon as you say sun or moon, you've got to use a symbol for a god next to it. The whole text avoids that. So the remarkable thing is that it avoids all sorts of it sends a message to its own culture in all sorts of ways by doing that sort of thing. But the way it expresses itself, it seems to me, is also expressing a message to us, that there are all sorts of possibilities that could be snuck into the way it's expressed without contradicting it, even if those possibilities don't automatically and quickly spring to mind as you read it.
And also not naming Satan, calling him not a winged serpent, was a way of making sure that he wasn't then identified as a deity in a, you know, sort of polemic conflict. You know, just a way of...
And the great sea monsters are just God's playthings. Whereas in the nations around, conquering the sea monster was a big issue for any divine being.
Now, the first 3 days of creation had an evening and a morning.
Yeah.
So you're saying perhaps the light from stars or something else was permitted to regulate those days?
Well, I don't know that there were too many creatures around needing much regulation to the fourth day. they do have an evening and morning, and what do you make of it? I think the whole point is to separate light out from the light bearers. So you don't worship the sun again. The sun in the ancient world was worshipped as the source of light. By creating light first and then only a few days later delegating the function of that to the sun, the moon and the stars is a way of saying that they are not the sources. They are just bearers of light. They are not divine in themselves. From a point of view of just looking at it, it seems crazy, I admit. But I think it's conveying an important message. Yes?
My question is a little bit out of the ballpark of your precise topic, but the principles that you've been talking about would probably apply. If we take the time of Christ as a reference point, how far back beyond that can we go before we can start to regard the people mentioned, the incidents mentioned, and time frames as being literal?
All depends what you mean by literal, I guess, which sounds like an evasive answer. It's not meant to be. People will say they believe the Bible is literally true, and yet they'll speak in metaphor the whole time, but because it's common idiom, they don't realise they're doing it. I would prefer to say that I would like to read the Bible on its own terms, in terms of how they would have understood it. It's natural reading, but that may not be the, you know, what is natural to the first readers may be not be what's natural to me. So language may be being used in symbolic ways that I don't pick up on because I'm not from that culture. People will debate how far back archaeology can take us, for example. Archaeology is ultimately the science of people's rubbish. It's what they throw out. And sometimes rubbish tells you more about people than what they admit to even when they write, but it doesn't tell you everything. Sorry?
Failed architecture.
Yeah, well, none of it's... all fell. Well, eventually things do, don't they? My faith in terms of... You know, if I believe a text is teaching something is history, if you like, my faith is not determined by what the archaeologist may or may not have dug up yet. I take the Bible on its own terms. What I was saying this afternoon was, though, that once you get back beyond Abraham, you're getting back beyond time as Israelites would understand it. And that doesn't mean that it's not literal, any more than Captain Cook was not a literal person. Just because he never got to the Northern Territory physically doesn't mean he didn't exist. It doesn't mean that that story doesn't tell us what those people experienced, okay, as a result of all that. It does mean that he wasn't actually standing on the ground with them in the Northern Territory itself.
To be a little bit more specific, we could ask questions like, did Abraham actually exist? Did Moses actually exist?
I personally believe it. I can't prove it.
David actually existed. Around about the time of David, the approximate point where things were closer to us should be regarded as reliably...
I can't answer that question. For me, I have no problem accepting Abraham and Moses. I can't prove their existence, but I see no reason why we should say they didn't. Okay. Writing was around, historical records were kept. And even when I say Genesis 1 to 11 may be different, it's not because I don't believe God can do all those things. It is simply because it seems to me the genre is a little bit different because it's going back to a period before the existence of the group that's being talked about. There are some people who are very sceptical. There is in archaeology what is sometimes called maximalists and minimalists. The maximalists will try and see as much of the Bible as possible there being historical, and the minimalists will try and see as little as possible being there. One Old Testament scholar, I've forgotten his first name, Thompson, he... don't think related to Steve. This particular guy basically has nothing as accurate before the Persian period. There are scholars who dispute whether there was even a Temple of Solomon. I don't think that's most. Even if they're not believers in the sense we would think of, I think most accept at least that there was an historical David somewhere. Historical Moses may be much more doubted. But I'm conservative by nature, and I really can't see any reason why I shouldn't believe that that's historical, because I think there are things in the story itself that indicate the importance of it being history to the story. But whether that's history in exactly the way I would describe it's another question again. Job is one that comes to mind, right? Whenever Job was written, it was a long time after the events. Do we know exactly every word that Job's friends said to him? Can we vouch that that is exactly what they said as history? Maybe not. Okay. Is this a reconstruction and historical drama? Maybe. I can live with that very comfortably, but it doesn't make me doubt that the story may have actually been literal. I see no reason to doubt that. If I get to heaven and God says, you deal, it wasn't literal after all, I'll probably just chuckle to myself and be grateful that I'm there anyway.
Jesus endorsed the writings of Moses.
Sure did. And so do I. That's a different question again, of course, from strictly speaking from historical. Jesus endorsed the rich man and Lazarus. Okay, see, people can end up going round and round in circles on it. But I'm a person of faith at the end of the day. I don't just believe what can be proved to me, even though I believe appropriate... the Bible should be studied with appropriate methods. You know, if we can't use the methods we use, I know it's different to other writings, so I want to be very cautious about how I express it. But, you know, as soon as we say this is sacred writing, we can't investigate it in a normal fashion, we're in trouble. Okay? Adventists love the material Fawn Brody wrote, for instance, about No Man Knows My History, about Joseph Smith. We were very happy to apply standard historical techniques to Fawn Brody's investigation of Joseph Smith. We weren't so happy when those techniques were turned by Fawn Brody, amongst others, on Alan White. Okay, but we need to say that the Bible doesn't have to be set off in some special compartment where nothing can be investigated. We need to say that. But at the same time, as a person of faith, I say that I believe, because I'm a person of faith, much more than can be demonstrably proved. Because in this life, how much can be ultimately proved anyway? Norm.
Thank you, Ross, for your presentation. Many Adventists say that unless you accept the creation account as happening over 6 days in some kind of physical way, you have no defense for the Sabbath. And if you take a more poetic approach or see it as a parable or a literary piece, they would say that you've lost the Sabbath. What would you say to that?
I would point to the amount of creationist groups who say 6 literal days and aren't bothering with the Sabbath. It seems to me taking a very strict literal reading isn't making people Sabbath keepers in any large numbers as such. And it seems to me they've got the idea of true fall back to front. The question is, why did it write it that way? Whether it happened that way in a way we would measure or not, why would it write it that way? And the whole point, it seems to me, is precisely to present the Sabbath. It is teaching us that we need to rest in this pattern. God has set as a model, whether we observing God doing it would see it exactly the way we expect it or not, God has set as a model, therefore we should do it. The point is not just to tell history, the point is to tell us how to live. And when truth becomes a matter of telling history but not telling us how to live, then we're in serious trouble. And it seems that that's where most creationist groups outside the Adventist Church at least end up. That we We're accepting that this is truth, but we're not going to follow anything it says in terms of our practical lives. They are far more off track. And the Adventist says, well, I'm not sure if it was historically that way or not, but I know what God was teaching me to do from it.
Ross, thank you again. Are you telling me that I've got to take off my braces and go back to the there and the then and think in terms of the first readers of Scripture and then get my Western stuff back on and ask, what does God require of me here and now? So there and then and here and now, is that...
I think that's exactly it, and the challenge is how to put the two together. But I don't think we put them together by ignoring the difference.
Thank you.